at the end of 26. When Esau was 40 years old, he married Judith, daughter of Beeri the Hittite, and also Basemath, the daughter of Elon the Hittite. They were a source of grief to Isaac and Rebekah. 27. When Isaac was old and his eyes were so weak that he could no longer see, he called for Esau, his older son, and said to him, "My son." "Here I am," he answered. Isaac said, "I am now an old man and don't know the day of my death. Now then, get your equipment, your quiver and bow, and go out to the open country and hunt some wild game for me. Prepare me the kind of tasty food I like and bring it to me to eat so that I may give you my blessing before I die." Verse 5. Now Rebekah was listening as Isaac spoke to his son Esau. When Esau left for the open country to hunt game and bring it back, Rebekah said to her son Jacob, "Look, I overheard your father say to your brother Esau, 'Bring me some game and prepare me some tasty food to eat so that I may give you my blessing in the presence of the Lord before I die.' Now, my son, carefully listen and do what I tell you. Go out to the flock and bring me 2 choice young goats so that I can prepare some tasty food for your father, just the way he likes it. Take it to your father to eat so that he may give you his blessing before he dies." Jacob said to Rebekah, his mother, "But my brother Esau is a hairy man while I have smooth skin. What if my father touches me? I would appear to be tricking him and he would bring down a curse on me rather than a blessing." His mother said to him, "My son, let the curse fall on me. Just do what I say. Go and get them for me." So he went and got them and brought them to his mother, and she prepared some tasty food just the way his father liked it. Then Rebekah took the best clothes of Esau, her older son, which she had in the house, and put them on her younger son Jacob. She also covered his hands and the smooth part of his neck with goat skins. Then she handed to her son Jacob the tasty food and bread she had made. Verse 18. He went to his father and said, "My father." "Yes, my son," he answered. "Who is it?" Jacob said to his father, "I am Esau, your firstborn. I have done as you told me. Please sit up and eat of some game so that you may give me your blessing." Isaac said to his son, "How did you find it so quickly, my son?" "The Lord your God gave me success," he replied. Then Isaac said to Jacob, "Come near so I can touch you, my son, to know whether you really are my son Esau or not." Jacob went close to his father Isaac, who touched him and said, "The voice is the voice of Jacob, but the hands are the hands of Esau." He did not recognize him, for his hands were hairy like those of his brother Esau, so he proceeded to bless him. "Are you really my son Esau?" he asked. "I am," he replied. Then he said, "My son, bring me some of your game to eat, so that I may give you my blessing." Jacob brought it to him, and he ate, and he brought some wine, and he drank. Then his father Isaac said to him, "Come here, my son, and kiss me." So he went to him and kissed him. When Isaac caught smell of his clothes, he blessed him and said, "Ah, the smell of my son is like the smell of a field that the Lord has blessed. May God give you of heaven's dew and of the earth's richness, an abundance of grain and new wine. May nations serve you and peoples bow down to you. Be lord over your brothers, and may the sons of your mother bow down to you. May those who curse you be cursed and those who bless you be blessed." After Isaac finished blessing him and Jacob had scarcely left his father's presence, his brother Esau came in from hunting. He too prepared some tasty food and brought it to his father. Then he said to him, "My father, please sit up and eat some of my game so that you may give me your blessing." His father Isaac said to him, "Who are you?" "I am your son," he answered, "your firstborn Esau." Isaac trembled violently and said, "Who was it then that hunted game and brought it to me? I ate it just before you came and I blessed him, and indeed he will be blessed." When Esau heard his father's words, he burst out with a loud and bitter cry and said to his father, "Bless me too, my father." But he said, "Your brother came deceitfully and took your blessing." Esau said, "Isn't he rightly named Jacob? This is the second time he has taken advantage of me. He took my birthright, and now he's taken my blessing." Then he said, "Haven't you reserved any blessing for me?" Isaac answered Esau, I have made him lord over you, and have made all his relatives his servants, and I have sustained him with grain and new wine. So what can I possibly do for you, my son? Esau said to his father, Do you have only one blessing, my father? Bless me too, my father. Then Esau wept aloud. His father Isaac answered him, Your dwelling will be away from the earth's richness, away from the dew of heaven above. You will live by the sword, and you will serve your brother. But when you grow restless, you will throw his yoke off of your neck. Esau held a grudge against Jacob because of the blessing his father had given him. He said to himself, The days of mourning for my father are near. Then I will kill my brother Jacob.
Well, I don't know. I don't know about you, but there's definitely those moments. I was trying to think before this morning, man, what is the moment that I have felt out of control in my personal life and then did something stupid because I felt like all of the elements of my life were out of control? Then I thought of 100 stories, right? Like, then it becomes, which story do I tell in that moment? And then it becomes, well, which story can I tell in church out of those moments, right? It kind of narrows that down a little bit more. But in other words, it was pretty quickly in my mind that you begin to think of certain scenarios where you're like, I felt like things were spiraling and I scrambled. And in my scrambling, I made very unwise decisions. The ramifications of those decisions echo long past that moment, right? One of the points that I got lucky was we went into a conference a couple years ago with Chris Stevens and Carl, who are both gone this morning. But we went up to Grand Rapids for a conference, and I walked in. I was like, "Hey guys, we're getting ready to head to the conference." We check into the hotel. I was checking a text message on my iPhone, and I was like, "Hey, I'm going to go to the bathroom real quick, and then I'll be ready to go." And as I'm walking into the bathroom, it was like I had washed my hands with margarine or something right before I walk in the bathroom, because the moment I walk in, I'm from texting, my iPhone just goes like right in the toilet, right? And so in my desperation, right, losing control in that moment, I reach down into the toilet, grab it, and then begin to suck the water out of the phone and spit it into the sink, because I thought I have to save my phone from, like, the phone is wet. Consequently, your first thought is it needs to be dry. And so in this moment, I thought that would be the best thing to do. As I do so, Chris looks at me and he says, What are you doing? Like freaking out, like he should have done, like I should have done in the first place. Instead of calling the phone dead, my actions lead me to do something completely stupid, because in that moment, the panicking from losing my phone, right, supersedes any kind of logic, supersedes any kind of, I mean, that's a silly moment, except you know that that describes several moments in your life and several moments in my life, maybe not to that gross degree, if you will, but certainly in just the, yeah, I don't know why I did that, right? Yeah, I'm not sure what I was thinking in that moment. That there's no reasons for the things that you do. It's just that the drama and the emotion of the moment overwhelmed your best mental faculties and made you do something that really you weren't supposed to do, or that you would never do again. And if you could go back and only respond in a healthy way in that moment, boy, that would be different. That relationship wouldn't be broken if only I hadn't said that thing because I was just so angry. That maybe if I wouldn't have made that decision in the split second, I felt like it was the right thing to do. In fact, I didn't even think about whether it was the right or wrong thing to do. Out of my instinct, I just did this and that. That's what's going on in the story. I think we often know Jacob and Esau as kind of this tale of two brothers. And we kind of, if you've grown up in church, you may be familiar with the story of these two twins. In fact, the Bible says that they're so close that it uses this analogy of Jacob grabbing the heel of his older brother on the way out, like it's some kind of baby chain in the delivery room of sorts, right? That's how close these two were, yet they also couldn't be any more farther apart. It says that Isaac is the father here. Now, just to catch everyone up, we've been going through the book of Genesis, starting in Genesis 1, and now we're in 27, and we've been here for over half a year now since Christmas, right? And through all this, we've seen Abraham, and Abraham raises Isaac. So if you're in these shoes, grandpa to Jacob and Esau, grandpa is Abraham, right? Like put yourself in their family system. It's Grandpa Abraham and Grandma, anyone? Sarah, right? And you got some aunts and uncles who got cast out named Hagar and all the, I mean, all kinds of craziness there. But in the family system, Isaac is dad, and you're like really close to these familiar stories of Abraham and then now Isaac and then now Jacob and Esau. Now, this really comes into play a little bit later on. But in this story, what you have are two brothers who are similar in that they're actually twin brothers, but they couldn't be any differently. One is called Harry, right? And he's not only Harry, he's beyond Harry, where at least if you take the story at face value, like his mother says, if I kill a goat and put its skin around yours, that will be accurate for how hairy your brother is. Like that's beyond crazy if you really think about it, that dad could touch it and go, hey, Esau, how you doing, right? Like that's just kind of rough and weird and glad I don't have that certain condition, right, if you will. But anyway, so the brothers, though, they're twins, they couldn't be any more different. Now, dad, and this may play into your own family dynamics as well, dad has a favorite, and the favorite is Esau, right? And it says he loved Esau because he had a love of game. I don't think that's Catan. I don't think that's Sorry. Anyone remember Sorry? Or Trouble, the one with the dice that flip when you touch the clear bubble in the middle. What I'm talking about is that Isaac and Esau had very similar personality traits, right? That somehow the text is telling us that Isaac loved the hunt for a good kill. That the adventure of going out and seeking the food for the family was, there was something like really visceral and guttural about that. There's like that Tim, the tool man, Taylor sort of grunting that sort of like emerges out of that sort of mindset that there's that these two get along because he reminds me of me when I was little. Not me as in Matt Connor, that couldn't be any further from the truth, but reminding me as if I was Isaac. He reminds me of me when I was a kid. And so it describes Isaac. Isaac is in his twilight years. Isaac is so old that his senses are now deceiving him. He's blind. But Esau, apparently there is within that fabric of the family some memory that says, man, we used to go hunting together. I remember teaching him. And so you're left to wonder. Then on the other side, Rebecca has a favorite, and her favorite is Jacob, right? Now, we don't know why this is. Perhaps Jacob was left at home often while Isaac and while Esau went out to go hunt. And so maybe Jacob stayed home with mom and became a mama's boy, literally. Maybe Jacob was more domestic. Maybe Rebecca, the mom, felt sorry for the other brother. And so she kind of took him in under her wing. Maybe, just maybe, Rebecca actually knew the plan of God would come through the lineage of Jacob. If you're familiar with like Joseph and his amazing technicolor dream coat, right? I don't know that that's officially the biblical name of the story, right? But you're familiar with these stories. You know that through the line of Jacob comes all of our biblical heroes. And so somehow, maybe spiritually, Rebecca is actually the hero of the story. Maybe Rebecca's tuned in to God's plan, and so she favors the one son that she knows that God is going to favor. Now, we don't know the dynamics of the story. There's no way to personally tell. But at the very outset, what you can imagine is this is a dramatic scenario. If you read between the lines, what you have is dad has his favorite, and mom has her favorite. And that sets all kinds of things at odds with one another. If you've experienced this in your family, you know that that causes a lot of tension and grief at certain times. Now, the reason this is so huge is because by the time the Bible catches us up with the story, what the Bible is pointing us to is this crisis moment. Dad is about ready to die. And so dad has something to give to one of his sons. It's called a blessing. Now, there's a birthright and there's a blessing, and Esau was supposed to receive both. And between the two of them, you have the ability to inherit everything, right, from the father. This is what Abraham handed down. This is just what you do to the firstborn. The firstborn is, in this culture, the receiver of all that is good, and everyone else lives under the blessing of the firstborn. So Esau is rightfully in this culture the receiver of inheritance, and not just inheritance, but this blessing of who will make the calls for the family. Sort of the Don figure, if you will. Sort of this, like, I call the shots around here and whatever, right? That's a lame impersonation of Godfather movies. But you know what I'm saying. When I'm saying that, in other words, one person calls the shots. If you'll notice in previous stories, Abraham decided to go to a certain place, and it says his whole entourage went there. So this is what is going to be bestowed upon Esau in this instance. So this is a major moment. This is the moment where something's going to happen. Esau goes in. Dad says, I want you to go out. If we're going to do this right, let's do this right. You and I both know that we love the hunt and then eating the fruit of our labor. So Esau, go out and do what you do best, and you'll come back, and we'll just have this bonding moment again. And that takes time. Esau has to go out for the kill. Now, when Esau goes out for the kill, what happens in this instance is mom seizes the moment to manipulate him. Now, this is where it gets really sticky, because it's like any other story that we tell today. There is a way to make one person the hero and another person the villain, right? The name Kaylee Anthony and Casey Anthony may ring some kind of a cultural bell for you. I don't know really how it couldn't. But about in the last few weeks, the murder trial for the little girl Kaylee Anthony happened. Casey Anthony gets off of the charges before her, at least the major murder charges, and she walks. And all of a sudden, Facebook is aflame with like all these people declaring whether or not she should be out, right? Or whether or not she's guilty, or whether or not it's a good thing. In other words, there's a way to twist the story. Most people, I'm listening to people saying, oh man, you know, she's guilty and the courts got it wrong and all this stuff. And then a few weeks ago, my sister's a lawyer in Nashville, and we spent some time with family a few weeks ago, and I was talking to Megan, and Megan said, man, what do you think of the verdict? And I said, hey, you know, I don't know. I mean, I wasn't there, and what I have to say about it doesn't, who cares what I have to say, right? And so my sister says, you know what, I'm so thankful that we have a country where you're innocent until proven guilty, and despite the overwhelming media sensation around the case, like, I'm glad that there's a system in place that you have to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. And I was like, yeah, okay, I could see that, right? You can spin any story that you want, the current debate on the Hill, right? Some people, we could sit here and say, wow, Barack Obama is the hero and he's trying to do these good things. And in fact, other people on the other side, they're the enemy. And then I could talk to some others of you and you would say, John Boehner, he's trying to do these good things. And if Barack Obama would only get out of the way and he's a bad president. And in other words, even within this room, you could spin it as if one person was the hero and the other person is the villain. And then we have these fights about who sees what within the argument. And we've been doing this for forever. I remember reading history books when I was growing up, and it was like the beautiful, adventurous spirit of the early explorers, and how wonderful it was that Vasco da Gama and Ponce de Leon and Christopher Columbus braved the oceans and found the new world, and it's this great explorer spirit that epitomizes the new world and the settlement there. And then a couple months ago, my wife and I went to Montreal and Quebec City for to celebrate our anniversary. A little bit early. And while we were there for about a week and a half, we went to this museum and there was an exhibit from First Nations people that would be like Indians, what refer to as Native Americans, Eskimo tribes, Inuits, etc., right? There were all this art there from their perspective looking back on the history of America. And it's like, wow, they have a very, very different tale to tell than what I was taught all the way through like elementary, junior high, high school, right? In other words, this idea of one story being spun to tell it in a few different ways should be very familiar to us, because we see these things spun, whether on cable news networks or in the history books, depending on who wrote them. This is really huge, because what this means is that sometimes it's difficult to tell who is right and who is wrong. So what happens in a moment like this is typically someone with my title, pastor, right, or preacher or priest or special speaker or whatever, right, stands up in front of a group, looks at a thing like this, and says, Esau is evil, Jacob is good, and so therefore live this way. But then you start to read a little bit more and you're like, man, I don't know that it works that way. Who's the hero here? And who's the villain here? Is Rebecca the hero? Right? Is Jacob the hero? Because that seems really weird that Jacob is manipulating and deceiving a situation. And then, like, how is that the hero? God blesses the liar? Like, is that the lesson we're all supposed to learn here? Hey, guys, go home and manipulate all you want, and God has your back each and every time. Amen. And everyone agrees with that. And we've heard, like, how do you say that, right? Sometimes when I read this, I feel bad for Esau, right? Esau goes out expecting certain things to happen for him. I'm going to go kill something. I'm going to come home, and today may just be one of the best days of my life. It's like preparing and going for this like awesome date, and then you go on the date, and then everything couldn't go any worse. Like the waiter spills something on you the moment you arrive, even though you spent 2 hours getting ready. I mean, it's like one of those disastrous moments when Esau comes home. I just don't think the Bible does it justice when it says Esau let out a loud cry. I'll bet it was laced with a lot of like fist raised to the sky and a lot of profanity and a lot of, crazy, like, what? Like, what do you mean someone was already here? What do you mean? How could you fall for goat arm trick? You fell for the goat arm trick. How does that work? Dad, you may be blind, but you haven't lost your sense of touch. What are you thinking? What's wrong with you? And what do you mean there's only one blessing? There's got to be two blessings. Like, in other words, in the story, it's easy to feel bad for Isaac, but that's why I had Danielle read the last two verses of the previous chapter. It said that Esau had married two Hittite women. Not that there's anything wrong with Hittite women in general, except that the covenant given down from God to the family said, you're not allowed to marry other people. You're not allowed to intermarry with other cultures and consequently with their gods. And so you have to be careful of that. And apparently Esau purposefully disobeyed that for the sake of, well, the same reason we all do things in spite of what we know, because we feel like it in the moment, right? Because we see that there's advantages there. And so the last verse of 26 says, Isaac was a source of grief to his family. That Isaac was a source of grief. Esau was a source of grief. Now, I think even that is putting it lightly, right? I mean, I think in some way Esau then becomes the thorn in the family side. So you read that and you're like, oh yeah, Esau didn't deserve the blessing anyway. And good thing mom was there to manipulate dad, because dad is passive and old and he doesn't know what's going on. Isaac's the villain and Esau's the villain. And it's all about the good things of Jacob and God's with him. And in other words, there's a way to read this and go, I think Jacob's the enemy. And there's a way to read this and say Esau's the enemy, which makes it really, really difficult to make a point in a sermon when everyone is both good and bad and God acts in a way that is not conducive with what we learned in Sunday school, which is don't lie. Right? Isn't it one thing to try to learn the rules of morality, right? Like when I was growing up, we learned the Ten Commandments. When I was in a Christian school, we learned a song called The Perfect Ten with hand motions that went along with the Ten Commandments, right? Then I read this story and I'm like, then how come God gives a bunch of stuff to the people who lie and the people who don't lie and seem to just live the way they're supposed to get totally taken advantage of and manipulated and they lose, right? In other words, I was taught if you live in obedience to these things, good things will happen to you. And you read the scriptures and everything's turned upside down. So in other words, what do we do here? Well, I think the one point we can make out of all this, I think the one thing that kind of draws all the characters in, if we can't label them good or bad or hero or villain, I think the one thing that we can do is admit that they're all feeling like things are out of control and they're trying to control the scenario in front of them. I think in this instance, Isaac is trying to establish the way things were supposed to be. So this is a culture. If you happen to be born first, even if you're born first and I'm on your tail as closely as grabbing your heel, it doesn't matter, Jacob, you're out of luck. Your whole life is going to be lived under your brother, whatever that means, right? And so in some ways, Isaac is going along with the cultural flow. This is what we're going to do. We're going to control the situation. And when things spiral out of Isaac's control, it says that Isaac violently trembled, right? In some kind of, I've been deceived kind of way. And after that moment, Isaac is no longer mentioned. There's kind of this, he kind of disappears. But in the last vision you have of Isaac, who's considered this sort of patriarch of the faith, at least in this story, is this idea of like a dad who was manipulated and couldn't see. You almost wonder if that's a symbolism for like being unable to really see what was going on in the moment, not just physical blindness, but an overall blindness. Esau comes home and he freaks out. And then he says this, basically in the text, if you read it, it says, you know what, dad's going to die. So I'm going to wait. And then after my dad's dead, I'm going to go kill my brother. That's what I'm going to do. Like out of this, in other words, I feel like everything is out of control. So you know what I'm going to do? It's going to enrage me so much that I'm literally going to cease the life of my twin brother. Right? In other words, these emotions run really deep in Scripture. The same lives that we live that feel out of control and come with all kinds of, I'm going to, like, in the same way that we respond with rage and anger and revenge, the same sort of core emotions that are present here in the story. The Bible is not like a distant from us. It's actually very near to us if we allow it to be. Certainly in this instance, though, here's what's crazy. We think that Jacob is the good guy and gets away with it. And we think that Rebecca's clued in to God's plan and kind of carries it out. But even then, you can see very clearly that she feels like it's out of control. Okay, Jacob is my favorite son. And I just overheard Dad in his tent. He was like talking really loudly, so it wasn't that hard to hear. I mean, I don't know, right? But Isaac has said, Esau, we're going to pass on the blessing today. Today's the day that we've been talking about. So go out and shoot something and bring it back and we'll cook it and I'll bless you. And so mom in that moment says, I've got a window of time that I can manipulate something. And so mom says, okay, go out and kill to Jacob. Go out and kill a couple of kids, right? Like, in other words, it's not hard to hunt the babies. It's harder to get like real game. So just go out and make a quick slaughter. Bring it back. I will help you with this. I will actually make the food. I'll bring it in. You'll bring it in and we'll outfit you with goat skin. And then you'll go in. And then here's Esau's favorite coat. I just did the wash and it smells just like him. I used the fabric softener only on your clothes. So dad will totally be fooled by it. And then you go in and you have this appearance. And then we'll fool your father into manipulating this thing. Now here's what's crazy. She thinks even after the moment that they've gotten away with it. This is what the crazy part to me is. And even in the early study, it didn't even occur to me that this is what's going on. Because when you originally read it, you think, man, well, Jacob must be favored because he received the blessing. But look at the blessing again in the Scripture. What does it say is going to happen? It said Jacob is going to, that his brothers would serve him, right? In no way, shape, or form does Esau ever serve his brother. Never. Never. Right? Now, you could trace it historically that the descendants of Esau ended up serving the descendants of Jacob after a few generations. But then after that, Esau's descendants end up beating back Jacob's descendants. I mean, in other words, there is no like strict adherence to the blessing. Later on, it says that your brothers will bow to you. But we'll get to this part of the story where in Genesis 33, Jacob is the one that ends up bowing down to his brother Esau seven times, right? That, in other words, what's happening in this story is we think that Jacob's getting this great blessing, but the blessing never comes true. The blessing is never fully lived out. I think we read this story and we're like, wow, Esau, I'm not sure what he did. Or maybe he was the bad guy in the beginning and Jacob's the hero. And Jacob's the hero of our faith. And he lives out a blessing. And let's give a sermon about living out of blessing. I would never, ever, 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 ever want that blessing in my life. Because what happens? Immediately in that moment, a mother loses her favorite son. Right? Rebecca says goodbye to her son in that moment because she hears her other son say, I'm going to kill him. And knowing Esau and how crazy he can, I mean, if he drags home an elk or whatever he drug home, right? I think he can pretty much take Jacob, who's pretty good at like hanging out around the house and he lives in the basement and he doesn't really do much. Like, I think one brother can clearly defeat the other brother. And I think like he's going to make good on that. So I've called Laban up on the tin can phone with the line that we have attached 100 miles away. And I want you to run. And like later on, as we venture through the story of Jacob, what we're going to find is that Jacob like hightails it and goes to live with Laban, right? Now, we'll get to this after several chapters, but even just to encapsulate it, we know what happens. Jacob, you're going to live in blessing as a runaway from home. And then, just like you deceived, you're going to be deceived. You're going to see a really attractive girl and say, can I marry her? And your uncle, your family is going to say, yeah, work for me 7 years, right? He works 7 years, right? Some of you wouldn't do 7 days, right, for like someone. You're like, no, there's other fish in the sea. I don't want to work 7 days for her, whatever, right? Like some of you wouldn't even do that. 7 years of your life in slave labor. Then you get to the wedding day and he's fooled because it's the other sister that no one wants, right? So then he's like, no, 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 I want the other one too. Work another 7 years and I won't lie to you this time, right? So in other words, Jacob receives the blessing. What blessing? He has to leave home. He's always in fear of his brother who is going to kill him whenever he finds him, or at least that's the fear, right? And then even out of that, you go somewhere else and the next go to this safe place. Yeah, that's really safe. He made me a slave for 14 years before I could marry the girl I really wanted. And he made me marry the other girl that I never really wanted. And everything got screwed up, right? Like, that's really crazy. That is not blessing life. That is not certainly what Rebecca pictured. Certainly that's not what Jacob pictured. Certainly that's not what God would want to carry out. I think there's something that happens here in that whenever we think that things are out of control, we end up doing things. The whole family is split. Rebecca never sees her son again because she manipulated something in a window that she thought she could have. In other words, nothing good ever happens in the moment where we are supposed to seize control of whatever it is. Now, I'm not talking about taking advantage of opportunities. I'm not talking about being responsible and seizing the brass ring, right? I'm not talking about doing those kinds of things. What I'm talking about are those moments where we, in a panic, feel like we are supposed to be in control. And when we feel like things are toppling or spiraling out of control, we want to grab the steering wheel and take over in some sort of way. We want to grab the pen and begin to write our own story. We want to make something happen. In our isolation and in our feeling alone, we'll do anything to fill that. So we begin to make horrible relational choices just to have somebody. We end up thinking that, well, I feel insecure about the amount of money that I have, and if I manipulate in this way, I can make this happen and I can get this amount of money, except in the end it ends up burning us because we lose our integrity or we lose our character or we lose in this moment. I think all of us find ourselves in these instances where we feel like things are out of control. What we end up doing is we end up hurting not only ourselves, but then we end up breaking even the family systems and the communities around us for the sake of our own selfish gain. If there's anything that we could learn in this story, it's one pretty simple fact: that we were never intended to be in control. That we were never intended to be in control. I think that is the dominant theme in a passage like this, where you look at the characters and the way that they respond, and you pretty quickly note that humans aren't very good at grabbing something and making it happen. That we're not very good at manipulating a situation and working out for our own good. That usually it comes back around to us in some kind of karmic way, and it ends up haunting us far beyond what it would have been if we just would have been submissive. I'm in seminary right now. I'm taking an intensive class, a Greek class at Anderson's campus. And I'm sitting in class, this is a couple days ago. I'm sitting in class, and where I sit in class, I can see the door. And while the teacher's talking in all this Greek language that I'm struggling to understand, this guy walks by like twice and kind of glances in, and I can kind of see the traffic in the hallway. And the third time this guy walks by, I notice him because he's just kind of like standing there in the doorway, like looking straight at me, right? Like it's pretty clear. So I look over at him, and he looks like, I think I know this guy. And then this guy like points at me and he's like, and I was like, and so the professor's looking at me like, what are you looking at? And the girl who's like sitting in the doorway is like, why are you staring at me? I'm not trying to look at you. I'm trying to look beyond you, right, to the door. And the guy's pointing at me and he's like, and he mouths, Matt Connor, like Matt Connor. And I was like, Scott Green, right? This guy that I hadn't seen for like 8 years, for some reason is walking through the hardly ever trafficked hallway at the School of Theology at Anderson University. And he happens to see me. And so I'm like, hey, I got to go to the bathroom. And which I obviously don't, because everyone knows I'm like totally distracted by something in the hallway, a rattlesnake or the jelly green giant, whatever is out there. And I'm going to go see what it is. So I get up, I go out there, and I never come back to class, which was really nice. But I go outside, and I'm like, Scott, what are you doing here? Scott says this. Scott's a pastor at a church in Fort Wayne. And we go back to my early 20s. And hadn't seen Scott in forever. So he didn't know anything that has gone on with me for a very, very long time. So Scott said, you know, man, I'm going through the ringer right now. He's the associate pastor at a church. He said, you know, man, our pastor, he has a brain tumor. He's been given just months to live. He had headaches, went in, and then the doctors told him he's almost dead. And so it's thrown our whole church into craziness. And am I taking over the church? And I don't even know what's going on. And I've got my own issues, and I'm trying to figure out a bunch of stuff. And it was crazy. And I used to go to seminary here, and I totally didn't like it. I didn't finish. I didn't do well. And I hate this place. I don't even want to be here. But he said, I'm driving around Fort Wayne, and I felt like God told me, I want you to go back to that seminary in Anderson and just pray. And so he's like, man, I haven't even been back here since I didn't want to be here anymore. Driving in here made me feel the same knots in my stomach as I did 15 years ago. I'm sitting here trying to like just sit on this bench and read the Bible and kind of wonder, why did I take a day off of work to come to Anderson to sit in the seminary? And all of a sudden I heard your voice that I hadn't heard in like 8 years. And I keep like walking by so I don't like totally make a fool of myself. But then it did turn out to be you. And so I stood in the doorway pointing at you until you came outside to me. He said, and I think you may be the reason I'm here. And so then that puts a lot of pressure on me. Like, I don't have anything for you, dude. I didn't wake up with a fortune cookie with your name on it. I'm not quite sure what to tell you. I think it's a one-sided God communication about this moment because I don't really have anything for you. So he begins to unpack some of his life. And he says, well, why don't you tell me what's going on with you? I mean, how'd you end up here? Aren't you like pastoring a church here? And so I said, well, yeah. In fact, we started a church 7 years ago. But even before that, do you know what happened? No. So I tell him the story. I tell him the whole story of coming to the end of my own finances and having nothing and a car repossessed. I tell him about losing all of my friendships and relationships and not having anyone in my life and becoming suicidal because I felt so alone. I talk to him about blaming God for everything and not wanting anything to do with God and then feeling horrible because all I've ever done in life is like work vocationally for God, and then going, man, I'm out of luck now. Like the only thing I'm qualified to do, I don't even want to talk to God, let alone talk to other people about God. So now my whole life is just one mess and I'm going nowhere and all this stuff. And so I'm telling Scott my country song of a whole story, right? And I tell him of my own demise, of my own doing, by every bad decision I ever made. And my whole story is a series of these type of moments from the story. Trying to manipulate something for my own gain, trying to make things happen in my own power, trying to cover myself in the lies that I'm telling, trying to make life happen in my own strength, in my own power, and in my own wisdom. And so I told Scott, I said, Scott, so I mean, that's my story. It's pretty depressing. I came to the end of myself. Then somehow magically this church offers me a job in the same city I'm living in. And then I work there for a year and a half. And then later on they say, go start a church in Anderson. And then here I am. And now I'm going to a class and you're pointing at me. And I don't know what that means for you, but that's what it is. Well, Scott starts like really zeroing in on my story. I can tell in his eyes and the emotion and all this kind of stuff. And he tells me about this pastor of his who's going through this rough time with the brain. Rough time is an easy way to put it. Going through a brain tumor, right? And so Scott tells me this, and he said, he got really honest. He said, Matt, I feel like God is like calling me to like totally let go of a bunch of stuff and like listen, but I don't want a brain tumor and I don't want to lose my job. And I don't like what he was offering up was an honest, he was naming the resistance, right? Matt, it sounds good to get to a point where you've been. It sounds good. He was describing his pastor who said, yeah, I know that I'm dying, but like I'm so rich with God's spirit right now. I've never been closer with God right now. God is like feeding me and my family at such a deeper level than we ever have. We're actually thankful for this moment, and not all the time does he feel that way, but there's like a deeper peace that runs beyond the pain that the family feels right now. And so he said, I'm sitting in the office going, I've got nothing at that level. I feel like if the church were to fall on my shoulders, I would stand up and give like all my youth group illustrations that I have to give, and then I'd run out of stories after 6 months, and then I don't know what I would have to offer this whole community of people. And I just got to be honest, I'm really scared. And so I hear your story, and I'm hearing his story, and I know these things go together, and I know that's why I was supposed to be here today, but the problem is I'm afraid. And I don't want to have to go through a brain tumor or losing my job to get to some sort of spiritual level. And when he said that, I thought, when I was looking at this passage, I thought, you just verbalized what every single one of us feel. We want a life that's fully submitted to God, and yet we don't want to go through what we think are going to be like the scary, overwhelming, painful things to get there. I think all of us deep down really desire a fully submitted life that says, God, whatever it is that you want to do, I'm totally in. God, if you want to give a blessing to someone else, I want that. I don't want it, but I want it. You know what I'm talking about when I say, like, I don't want it, but I want it. It's that weird sort of cyclical statement of how we're so two-sided at times. Almost like, Lord, I believe, but help my unbelief, right? When the person cries out to Jesus. There's something there for us that I think in Scott's reaction to this whole thing, I'm like, Scott, I love it that you're being so honest. I love it that you're not lying to me about it. And I think God will bring you there. It doesn't take a brain tumor, or it doesn't take losing these things. It's just, for me, I would have never went there on my own. Like, I needed to lose my job and relationships, and I needed to hate God to love God. That's just what my journey required, but there's no formula for this, except the only part of it that's consistent with everyone is that the final denominator is the same for each and every one of us, that God does desire that we live with open hands. God, whatever it is that you want to do in my life, that's totally what I want. God, whatever it is that you want to do in my relationships, that's what I want. If you want to give me someone, that's great. And if not, that's not great, but that's great, right? God, I want financial security. I'm tired of not having it. I'm so tired of not having it, right? Us as a church, right? We want financial security. We would love savings. We'd love things paid off, and we'd love new floor in here, and we'd love repainted walls, and we'd love a community that could actively use this, and keys that would actually work, and windows that weren't broken out. Like, we'd love that stuff. And so if you think the prayer life of our leaders aren't filled with, God, please, like, we've just been so tired of this. And just, like, is there like a sugar daddy somewhere, spiritual sugar daddy that can write us a major check and give it to us, and then we're totally set and good? Why? Because I'm tired of worrying about it, right? I'm tired of living on the edge. You guys know what I'm talking about. You get tired of feeling fragile, and you get tired of not having things work the way that you want them to. I think in this instance, Rebecca said, I'm tired of my favorite son not having the things that I think he deserves. And if that means I split the family over it, I split the family over it. Here's what's crazy. In spite of our own selves not having been made to be in control, which I think is the thing that we can pull from this, that you and I were never intended to have control over our lives, here's what's crazy. God is always in control. We talk about Jacob being a blessing. Later on, what we'll find, there's a place called Bethel. There's a place that Jacob comes to the end of himself. Jacob goes through a wrestling, right? A literal wrestling with the angels that leaves him with a limp in some weird way. It's my favorite story in all of Scripture besides one other one, and we'll get to that in way later on. But anyway, the story of Jacob wrestling with the angel leaves him with a limp, and he ends up like changed, forever changed. And it's in that moment that God gives Jacob the blessing that he was wanting from his own father in the first place, right? That what Isaac was offering to his son was just a typical blessing in that culture from one generation to the next. And it was not the God-centered blessing or the covenant that we've been talking about in the life of Abraham and the life of Isaac. What happens is that God ends up coming in and giving Jacob the blessing himself. In other words, you can step back and go, man, if God's going to give the blessing anyway, maybe Jacob didn't have to manipulate something to get it in the first place. Maybe Jacob didn't have to jump through all the hoops that he thought that he did Jacob made everything happen in his own strength and power. And the next thing you know, he has a fractured family. He's a runaway. He's in slave labor for 14 years. And he's got a mess of a life. Wondering, is this really what the blessing of God is in this moment? I don't know who's hero and who's villain. I don't know who to say to follow this and not follow that. What I do know is this. What I know is that every single one of us were not intended to have control over our own lives and to make life happen in our own strength and our own power and our own ability. What I do know is that God is fully capable, more than capable, of being able to control our lives for us, and in fact asks us to submit control of our lives over to God and be willing to let it rest there, no matter how panicked we get, no matter how crazy the circumstances go, even if we see a window that, well, let me take it right now and manipulate it, and then I'll give it back to you, God. Well, I think we've learned time and time again throughout the scriptures is walked out in the life of Jesus, who just continues to remind us not to worry about tomorrow, not to strive in our own flesh, not to try to make things happen, but only to be obedient to what we see God doing in the world and then respond accordingly. Does this stuff make sense as I'm saying this? This is huge for us to learn to live out of control lives, not in a reckless way, but in a God-submitted way. Let's pray this morning. God, we are... God, I'm thankful to you that you are in control despite a lot of the craziness I feel, in particular with church, in particular with wishing that we had certain things that we don't, in particular with wishing we had certain people that we may not, in wishing that we had... it's easy for us to look around and say, oh, these other communities have that. I wish we had that. It's easy for us to look around at our family. It's easy for us to look around at other people and say, I wish I had that job. I wish I had that family life. I wish I had that relationship. God, help us to only look to you. Help us to only rely on you. Help us to not take control. God, it's hard sometimes because we lack patience. So those of us who are tired and just at that last thread of resistance, give us the resolve, give us the energy to be able to just continue to only look to you. Those of us about ready to hit the panic switch, God, I pray that you just give us that peace of knowing everything is going to be okay despite the fact that we feel so overwhelmed. God, would you still our anxiousness? Will you speak to the storm that we feel is surrounding us, and that God, that we would experience some of that open space that we even prayed about earlier. God, we just thank you for a moment like this, for a story like this that speaks to us still today, thousands and thousands of years later. And so we give you this time in your name. Amen.